Yeah, so we'll just I wanted to talk about a famous Rambam that's very relevant. A famous Rambam that everybody should know because it's very, very relevant about the whole Exodus story and about the Yesodos of Emunah. And that is the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva talks about the idea of free will. That every Jew, every person has free will. Not just Machlokes, I said every person or every Jew. I think the Babaji Rebbe has a whole shir that Bechira was only given to Am Yisrael. That God don't have Bechira. Okay, that's a separate issue. Although from the Rambam's questions about Pyro, the implication is that non-Jews had Bechira too. And I think the Rebbe said that was only before the Torah was given. After the Torah was
given.
How
could they be rewarded or punished if they don't have
Yeah. Well, I mean, Chari, that's right. Because again, the Rambam argues that there's such a thing as Bechira logically. And the Rambam basically says, if Hashem would determine if a person is righteous or not righteous, and God made you behave a certain way, then how could he reward you for the good that you do? And how could he punish you for the evil that you do? There is no merit. I mean, a machine, right? A machine that just works the way it's supposed to work. You know, we might say it works, but we wouldn't call it good or evil. You can't care sometimes, although some of you feel a computer is an evil thing. But generally speaking, right? In other words, the Rambam argues that the whole yisoid of schar v'yonesh presupposes free will, because without free will, there cannot be accountability for action. Moreover, the Rambam says, free will is the reason why you have to do tshuva, because if my rishus was preordained, why do I have to do tshuva? And free will is also the reason why tshuva is possible, because if I wouldn't be capable of changing, right, there couldn't be tshuva, right? So the Rambam essentially grounds free will in a combination of the concepts of schar v'onesh and tshuva. And altogether, that creates the concept of free will. Now, free will itself does not mean everybody is the same. For example, in different stages, Rav Dessler introduces a very important idea called the Nekudas HaBechira. Nekudas HaBechira is the fulcrum point where I have a choice, meaning to say the following. Let's take a Jew that's already a Shomer Shabbos for 20 years. Maybe even less than that. We no longer say that every time he walks, every time he goes outside, he has the Bechira to be Mechal Shabbos or not be Mechal Shabbos. That issue is resolved. That's not an active, conscious issue that he's struggling with. Hashem will reward him for keeping Shabbos, but Hashem is not going to reward him because he made the choice to keep Shabbos instead of desecrating Shabbos. Now, when he was first beginning...
So why will he reward him? This is the phrase you said there. Why will he reward him?
Well, he's doing a mitzvah. In other words, he's doing a mitzvah, but he's not going to get the mitzvah, the reward of choice. 20 years before, when, you know, keeping Shabbos was a very hard thing for him, that was the fulcrum. That was the point, in, the tipping point, which could go either way. So the tipping points is where you get your main schar. That's your main avodah in life. But that tipping point changes as you go through. Kashrus is the same thing, right? When you begin to keep kosher, and you don't go into that McDonald's, or you don't go to the university meal plan, you know, you're going to get great reward. In a way, once you become kosher, you can ask, well, that's unfair. That means the thinner I am, the less reward. Well, no, there's always going to be a tipping point, you know? It may not be conscious, it may be Lashon Hara, it may be, you know, Dip Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. So Rav Dessler says, the same way some issues get resolved, that they're no longer within the struggles of your choice, it's equally true that there are certain issues that you're not yet ready to make a positive decision. So for example, a drug addict. Hashem is not going to tell a drug addict after 120 years, you know, why were you not in Kollel? The drug addict, you know, was not in a place where he could have made that choice. But he could have made the choice to seek treatment. Okay, so Bechira does not necessarily mean everybody is capable of all the choices all the time. But it means that there's always going to be a tipping focal point in your life where you could go either way. And the determination of who you are depends on what you choose at those critical junctures in life. Right? That's kind of scary. These critical decisions can determine everything. Okay, so that's the Rambam's din of Bechira. But then the Rambam proceeds to ask three questions. And these questions, it's important that you know the three questions. They're not all, sometimes people jumble them together. Question number one is a more philosophical question. And that is, that's a famous philosophical question. How do you understand God's knowledge of the future with human bechira? That's a famous, famous question that everybody asks. And that is, well, God knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. And God not only knew it today, God knew it yesterday, and God knew it a million years ago. And God knew it before the world, before the universe ever came into existence. Now, if God has absolute certain knowledge of what I'm going to do before I do it, then how can it be said that by the time I get up and I wake up Monday morning, I have the choice? Is not the choice foreclosed by God knowing ahead of time what it is that I'm going to choose, right? This is called philosophically, there's a term for this question. This is called the stira, the contradiction, bein yediyah, between God's knowledge, ubechira, and human autonomy. So the Rambam gives an answer that I think only a philosopher would love. He gives a very philosophical, Aristotelian type of answer. And he says the following. He says, you know, God is said to be a single, indivisible entity. God is simple. Now, the word simple in Aristotle doesn't mean unsophisticated, but simple just means that Hashem is not made up of parts. Unlike a human being that has a hand, a foot, etc., God is a total unity. Now, because God is a total unity, God's knowledge is not a faculty superimposed on his essence. For example, there's me and there's what I know. Right? My knowledge, although it's not a physical thing, my knowledge is a quality that can be separated from me. But since God is an indivisible unity, there is no quality of God that can be separated from God's essence. Therefore, Maimonides says, to understand how God knows things requires that you know who God is, that you know God's essence, because God's essence and God's knowledge is the same. And since it's impossible for us to understand God, it's impossible for us to understand God's knowledge. And therefore, Maimonides basically says, we cannot answer how God's knowledge is reconcilable with God, with human free will, because God's knowledge and God's essence are the same thing. Now, the Ravid says right off the bat, with some annoyance, that if you can't answer the question, why did you ask it? Meaning, you're raising questions and you're not giving good answers. So the Ravid himself says something that's quite surprising. The Ravid says, God's knowledge of the future is predictive knowledge, not coercive knowledge. Example would be the following. Let's say, you know, your mother knows you well, and your mother knows that your favorite ice cream is chocolate. So, whenever there's ice cream at home, and she always asks, you want vanilla or chocolate, she knows you're going to choose chocolate. Now, she knows because she knows you well, and she can make a prediction. She's not influencing your choice. She's not creating your choice. She just knows. Now, in human prediction, there can always be a margin of error. Because, you know, even if, you know, 99 out of 100 times you've ordered the chocolate, you know, any one day you might change. But theoretically, if one's knowledge of someone is so complete, then there would be no error in the prediction. So the Ravid's argument is that because God's knowledge of us, in other words, it's not that God knows the future, which is actually pretty astounding. He doesn't say God does not know the future. God knows you. And since God knows every single stimulus that you have ever experienced in your life from birth until the present moment, so God is in a position to make predictions with perfect accuracy. God is, you know, times infinity, the mother who knows that you're going to choose chocolate ice cream every time. Now, That's a very astounding idea. In other words, that basically says God's knowledge of the future is in the nature of predictive accuracy at a level of 100%. Now, I have a problem with that fundamentally, because I believe that if you say there is such a thing as predictive accuracy at a rate of 100%, that itself destroys free will. And in fact, that's a common argument that psychologists have made. This goes back to John Watson, who was a famous behavioral psychologist at the beginning of the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, where he actually said that if we knew, in other words, he said he denied free will by basically saying every decision we make is a product of all of the influences that have been acted upon on our genetic structure. And if you took two people, like twins, same genetic structure, and you subjected them to the same environmental influences, there would always be identity. So it seems to me that once you move towards a 100% predictive accuracy model, you're essentially following Watson that says we are a product of the stimuli plus our genetic endowment. I mean, that goofa undermines free will. Okay. It's a very difficult driving. But one of the other explanations they give to this question, and again, this is a philosophical complication, is that the contradiction between foreknowledge and free will is only a contradiction when you're operating within the framework of time. In linear time, there is a past, present, future. So in effect, the future choice has been ruled out because of the past knowledge, which already knows what the choice is. And then you have a problem. How can there be choice at that future date if before we got to that date, the choice was already known? But that's only a problem when you look at the future as coming after the past. But since God operates in a realm that's above time, so for God, everything that ever happens is a concurrent, although that's also a time-bound concept, is a concurrent reality. Now, for example, if I see what you're doing while you're doing it, I'm not interfering with your free will. I'm simply observing your actions. So for God, it's not that God sees in the past what will happen in the future. Rather, past, future, present are merged as a simultaneous instant. So God is simply watching what is going on, and he's not interfering with choice, right? So that's, a philosophical argument, that it is only from the perspective of linear time that, in other words, in which something is before something else, in which, well, there's no choice now because we knew what the choice was before. But with God, it's not a before and a now. Everything is now. So God's seeing what you're doing. It's not interfering with the choice. I see you sitting here. I did not make you sit here, and I didn't make the choice for you. You made the choice. I'm just observing the choice that you made.
How does that differ? How does that answer differ from saying that God sits from the end of time, which is wherever time ends, and he looks back and he now knows what happened at every given instance?
Yep.
That would seem to say that it's set. That everything is set.
It's not set. Well, it's not set, but
since he's seen it from, he's already outside it. It's
hard to understand because there's time and there's being outside of time. But basically, God is seeing what you are choosing, and from God's perspective, it's all happening at the same time. So, in human terms, there's a blocking off of time as a sequence of moments. But in reality, or in the spiritual reality, it's all concurrent. But ultimately, we're kind of left with the Rambam, that we don't really understand that type of perception. All right, so that's question number one. So question number one is philosophical. But the other two questions are textual. And that gets us into the Chumash itself. But question number two says, what did Hashem tell Avraham? Hashem told Avraham, you shall know that your children will be slaves in a land that is not theirs, and they will be afflicted, and they will be, they'll be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will be enslaved, and they will be persecuted, for 400 years. And we discussed yesterday the different calculations, the 210 and the 430 and the 400. And then it says, but the nation that oppresses them, I will punish. That's a prophecy, of course, that the Egyptians are going to suffer the 10 plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea. So the Rambam asks the following question. If God decreed that the Jews would be subjugated, they would be enslaved, they would be oppressed, then the Egyptians had no choice. God decreed that this has to happen. So why should the Egyptians be punished? In other words, if the Rambam's argument is that without free will, there can be no punishment, then how could the Egyptians be punished if God decreed that they would enslave? So here the Rambam gives the following answer. The Rambam answers, number one, God did not decree that the Egyptians be the enslavers. In fact, you'll notice, God didn't say who. God just says in a land that is not theirs. And certainly, Hashem did not decree any individual Egyptian has to behave a certain way. So even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer that the Jewish people will undergo servitude and slavery, every single individual had free will and free choice, and for that they can be accountable. Now, the Ramban asks, well, but they're still doing the will of God. But that's a different question than the Rambam. You see, the Rambam is asking, if God decreed, then there's no free will. So what's the Rambam's answer? There is free will because God didn't decree that you pull the trigger. God didn't decree that you wield the whip. Good. So every person had freedom. Ramban, however, is asking a different question. Okay, every person has freedom. But if God decreed to Abraham that the Jews are to be enslaved, then any person who does that should be able to claim the mantle. Hey, God, I'm doing a mitzvah. I'm doing your bidding. That's a different. That's not a bechira question. That's a question of why should God punish? On the other hand, the argument is, well, God said I'm going to punish you. God, in other words, it's kind of God saying that the Jews are going to suffer, but I am telling you, anyone that makes them suffer is going to get punished for it. Now, that's consistent. As long as God is not forcing the Egyptian to do the bad thing, God is announcing very clearly, yes, the Jewish people are going to suffer because they're going to be bad people who are going to persecute them. But I'm telling you now, don't come back to me afterwards after you persecute the Jews and say you did a mitzvah, because I'm laying down the ground rules that, you know, you're going to get punished, right? But the Rambam was concerned, if God was mechayev the Egyptians to do it, how could they get punished? The answer is, no Egyptian was chayev. Yeah.
On the Ramban's question, yeah, would it be a similar or identical case where there's a prediction of Jews going off the derech?
Right. What are you going to say? God says there'll be Jews going off the derech, so if I go off the derech, I say, Hashem, I'm doing your will. That's right. Even when Hashem decrees there are going to be certain evils, that doesn't exonerate the evildoer. And that's a very important idea. You know, we could say, for example, this is true, I mean, goes beyond Mitzrayim. Every galus that we have is connected to the sins of Am Yisrael. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Raya, Shemichus Tavanim, and Hashem decreed Korban. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. The Holocaust, we don't have definitive Nevuah or a minor Chazal. But Gedolim have pointed out to assimilation, there are different things going on. But does that mean, God forbid, that Hitler and the Nazis, you know, are not responsible because they're carrying out God's will? Of course not. They had Bechira. And those who do evil acts are going to be responsible for it, even if Hashem decreed that for whatever reason the Jewish people need to suffer. Right? That's a very so. This Brisman Absarim is a very fundamental idea that although we do blame the victim, so to speak, in the sense of having to do tshuva, but we never that is never used as an exoneration for the people who do evil. Right? That's the issue. Okay. So that's Rambam's second question. Right? So the first question is the contradiction between free will and God's knowledge. The second question is How could the Egyptians be punished if God decreed servitude in the Brisbane Absarim? And the answer there is, Hashem decreed the servitude, but Hashem didn't decree which nation and which individuals would do it, and for that they are accountable for their choices. Yeah.
Does that lend support, the Rav had mentioned in a different shir, that if somebody is deserving of murder, and somebody else is wanting to commit a murder,
right,
that Hashem will put them together?
That's exactly right, that's exactly right. Which means, theoretically, if everybody in the world were righteous and didn't want to enslave the Jews, Hashem would have to figure out some way to do it. I don't know what would happen. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs this massive matchmaking service in which he matches the trillions of decisions that human beings make with the aggregate results. I mean, again, the Chovas HaLevavos says, Befeirush, that nothing happens to you, good or bad, unless God decreed it. So if somebody kills you, somebody kills, right? Reuven kills Shimon. Reuven had free will. But if Reuven would have decided not to kill Shimon, Shimon would have died some other way anyway.
That's the one opinion, though. That's not...
That's the Chovas HaLevavos. Actually, that's not the Rambam's opinion. Right? We talked about that with...
Yeah.
Rechaim, okay.
But does that...
But this is different. But what I'm saying is different. What I'm saying is, though, the Egyptian servitude and Golos is different because there God did decree. In other words... Even if you don't accept the Chovas HaLevavos, that anything that happens to me, God decreed, but when it comes to Yitzias Mitzrayim and Golos, there you are dealing with the direct divine decree. So Hakol Moedim, that you have to follow the Chovas HaLevavos there, in that case, and basically say that slavery would have been inevitable, it would have to have happened, but Hashem did not decree who would do it. Yeah.
Just to clarify, Jews, when Hashem told Abraham that children would be slaves before that,
right,
that didn't mean that if the Jews stayed on, if they were righteous, they could have not been slaves.
Well, that's actually another issue. That is, there is a concept that the Rambam articulates, generally, that even a prophecy can be rescinded through tshuva. The Rambam's rule is there is no such thing as an irrevocable negative prophecy. It's an interesting point. So apparently, even after God tells Avraham, your children will be enslaved, that could have been circumvented by some process of tshuva. Yeah, which is pretty amazing. That would be the Rambam's point. That's why when you test the Navi, to see if his predictions are accurate, you can only test him with a positive prophecy that didn't happen. That proves he's a liar. But a negative prophecy that didn't happen doesn't prove anything, because maybe Hashem had mercy. That's correct. All right, so now we come to question three. Question three is the idea that Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Now that means that Paro would have wanted to send the Jewish people free because of the plagues. But Hashem made his heart hard, meaning that even if he wanted to send them, there was something in him that says, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to do it. And Hashem made him feel that way. Now there, and why is that so? So Hashem could continue to bring maka after maka after maka. He says, I don't want you to get out of, you know, just letting him go now. I want you to say no so I can keep on beating you. Now there, you do have a problem. Because unlike the Gezerah to Avraham, which did not connect to a particular individual, here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically hardened the heart of a particular individual. So now you have a real problem. How could Paro be punished for decisions that he made because Hashem hardened his heart? That seems to be a direct override of Bechira, and it's unjust to punish somebody when Hashem is not letting them make the choice that they otherwise would have made. Right? You understand how the Rambam's answer to the Brisbane of Sarim is not an answer for this. That's why it's a third kasha. And here, the Rambam also gives us a very, very beautiful yisayit. The Rambam says the following. We know that when a person does Averos, there are punishments for these Averos. The punishment could be in this world, could be in the next world, whatever it is. But a punishment in this world can sometimes be the loss of a faculty. A person could lose an arm, lose a leg, die, you know, whatever it is. So the Rambam's Chiddush is, the same way as a punishment for Avera, a person could lose their capacity to see or hear, a person could lose their capacity to exercise free will. But it's a punishment resulting from their averus. So here's what the Rambam says. The phrase, Hashem hardened Paro's heart, only appears in the second five makos. In the first five makos, it only says Paro hardened his own heart. So the Rambam says, after repeatedly refusing to listen to Hashem, even though Hashem is showing him all of these miracles, and Paro, out of his evil nature, refuses and refuses and refuses, volitionally, through the exercise of Bechira, he reaches a point of no return where he loses the capacity of free will. But it's not unjust to punish him, because the loss of free will came from the exercise of free will repeatedly. So that's how the Rambam learns that. Now, you can even understand this psychologically in terms of addiction, right? A person is in the throes of a cocaine addiction. Now, in many ways, he doesn't have free will at that point. He can't, the pain, the suffering, of not taking it is so overpowering that he has to take it. And yet, he is held accountable because there were many, many free will decisions that put him in this situation. And therefore, if as a result of your free will, you put yourself in a place where you no longer have that free will, you're accountable for the consequences. A drunk driving is the same thing. You know, a guy's drunk, he's driving a car, and he goes through a red light and kills some children. Now, if you just took a snapshot, take a snapshot of him at that moment, you could make an argument. Why should he be responsible? He couldn't think clearly. He couldn't see clearly. You know, he couldn't react. He says, there was nothing I could... I mean, this is an argument. There was nothing I could do when I went through that light. Or let's say he blacked out. He fainted. You know, he fainted. He says, what could I do? I fainted. Well, if you just took a little snapshot of that moment that he killed the child... He didn't have bechira at that point. So why is a drunk driver responsible? Because when he was taking drinks in the bar, knowing he was going into the car, right, then he was making choices that he knew would turn into could turn into something dangerous. So the point that the Rambam is making is, you can lose your bechira as a result of your choices, but you're accountable for the evil that happens because ultimately you lost your Bechira because of your Bechira. And that's exactly Hashem hardening Paro's heart. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say, it's a crazy hypothetical, but I'll just give a hypothetical. Let's say that I get you drunk and you're planning on going to sleep, but I just then put you in a car, put a seatbelt on you, turn on the ignition, and in a drunken stupor, you simply drive the car away. Now there, right, you didn't make a choice to do something that would result in your driving the car. So in a chinami, at that point, you went through the light, you would actually not be responsible for killing the child. Right? You see the difference, because there, your lack of free will did not result from your making bad choices. You never made a bad choice. You were intending to go to sleep. Somebody put you in the car, right? So that would be the difference. So now the Maral of Prague, just as Maral of Prague gives another answer, very interesting answer to the idea of free will. The Maral of Prague says, let's look at it the other way. Instead of Hashem overriding Paro's free will, maybe Paro had the greatest free will that ever existed, because normally what happens is this. It's Hashem's chesed, actually, that he puts difficulties in our lives to make us do tshuva. In other words, normally, Paro says no, no, no. Hashem says makos. Now, the way a maka works on a normal person is, it overpowers his free will to rebel against Hashem. and it kind of forces him to do tshuva. So Hashem hardening Paro's heart, the Maral says, is not that Hashem made Paro say no. No. It means Hashem made Paro impervious to pressure. So he had the purity of being able to decide yes or no. In other words, Hashem basically said, it's going to be your choice, and I'm not going to allow the Makos to influence you. So Zepta Maral, tremendously, this was not an override of Bechira. If anything, the Makos is an override of Bechira, and Hashem took away that override from Paro. So Paro was able to be totally objective. Now that itself is a punishment. In other words, but it's not a punishment that took away Bechira. It's the punishment that says you're not going to get the advantage of externalities that make you turn to Hashem. Right? So that's the opposite of the realm. So this is, a very famous passage in Hilchos Tshuva. Just to be aware of these three problems of the Rambam, the contradiction between omniscience. Right, omniscience is knowledge of all things that will happen versus free will, to understand the parsha of the Bris Ben Habsarim, and to understand Hashem hardened Paro's heart, right? And the Rambam tries to reconcile all of those ideas with Bechira. Now overall, why does Hashem want a world of Bechira? So once again, good is good only if it's chosen, not if it's preordained. So in a sense, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to maximize goodness in the world, he has to give us the capacity for choosing evil. Otherwise, if Hashem made a world where you could only choose good, then it wouldn't be good. Good is good because you can choose the other side. Now what's interesting is that this might also be an explanation of why bad guys sometimes come out on top. Like, why do tzaddikim suffer and Rishonim prosper? Right, that question that even Moshe didn't know. Well, let's look at it the other way. What if Hashem made a world where every time you did good deeds, you got $1 million? And every time you did an Aveira, so you would get a graduated electric shock, starting off at a half volt, and with repeat offenses, it goes up. Now, in the old Skinner's box experiment, where if the pigeon presses one lever, it gets a shock, and if the pigeon presses another lever, it gets a piece of corn. Even a dumb pigeon, pigeons are not that smart, gets conditioned. So if Hashem made a world where goodness was consistently, immediately rewarded in an open, apparent way, then I would be conditioned to choose the good. But then it wouldn't be a virtuous choice. I'm not choosing goodness because it's good, because it's emes. I'm choosing goodness because it pays off. So if you think about it, kind of auxiliary to the principle of free will, there has to be the notion that there's not immediate positive feedback for good, and there's not immediate negative feedback for evil, because then you would be taking free will and turning it into naked conditioning, which once again does not have any spiritual virtue. If a bird is trained to push a certain lever to avoid pain, we would not call that a virtuous choice, right? So in a sense, we could say evil is a necessary evil, meaning to say the existence of evil is necessary in order for goodness to be a chosen commodity and not a conditioned commodity. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Have a good Shabbos.